Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host What's Next for Birthright Citizenship, featuring Amy Swearer and Professor John Yu. Our moderator today is Professor Kurt Lash. Kurt Lash is the E. Claiborne Roberts Distinguished Chair in Law at the University of Richmond School of Law, and the founder and director of the Richmond Program on the American Constitution. Professor Lash has published widely on the subjects of constitutional law and constitutional history, including the books The 14th Amendment and The Privileges or Immunities of American Citizenship, The Lost History of the 9th Amendment, and The American First Amendment in the 21st Century, Cases and Materials. An elected member of the American Law Institute, his work has also appeared in numerous legal journals. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Professor Lash, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Marco, and my thanks to the Federal Society for hosting this important debate. I have the brief honor of introducing today's topic and our distinguished panelists, and I'll try to make this quick so we can get to the main event. In 1868, the people of the United States ratified the 14th Amendment to the United States Constitution. The first sentence of Section 1 of that amendment declares, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Often called the Birthright Citizenship Clause, this text actually requires more than birth to become a national citizen. One must also be born subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. The meaning of that second requirement remains a subject of significant debate, in particular, whether it applies to persons born to non-citizen parents illegally in the United States or to non-citizen parents only temporarily in the country. On January 20th of this year, President Donald Trump issued an executive order declaring that the United States government will no longer recognize as citizens of the United States two categories of persons who were born on United States soil. First, citizenship status is denied to persons born to non-citizen mothers not legally present in the United States unless their father is a citizen or a lawfully permanent resident. Second, the same is true for persons born to legally present non-citizen mothers who are only temporarily in the United States, once again, unless their father is a citizen or a lawful permanent resident. A coalition of states immediately filed suit in the federal district court, and in a blink of an eye, District Court Kogenhauer issued a temporary restraining order against what the judge described as a, quote, blatantly unconstitutional, end quote, order. Other similar suits have been filed around the country, and it seems reasonable to expect that the issue will arrive at the Supreme Court in the near future, one way or another. To help us understand the arguments that the Supreme Court will likely consider at that time, we're honored to be joined by two distinguished constitutional scholars. First, Amy Swearer. Amy's a senior legal fellow at the Edwin Meese III Center for Legal and Judicial Studies within the Heritage Foundation. Amy writes broadly on subjects relating to the Constitution, the Second Amendment, and increasingly these days, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. For example, Amy's the author of The Subject of Complete Jurisdiction Thereof, Salvaging the Original Meaning of the Citizenship Clause, the Texas Review of Law and Politics. John Yu is the Emanuel Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley. He also will be the Distinguished Visiting Professor at the School of Civic Leadership at the University of Texas, Austin. John is a prodigious writer, speaker, and public servant. He clerked for Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas, and he worked in the Department of Justice. And like Amy, John has been increasingly called upon to address the citizenship clause, an issue that he also has written on. For example, John recently penned an essay for the Civitas Institute titled "Birthright Citizenship is American Citizenship." Beginning with Amy, each panelist will take about 10 minutes to present their general thesis. I'll then give them both a chance to respond to each other and then perhaps respond to a question or two from me, the moderator, but we'll then devote the remainder of the hour to taking questions from you, our listeners. Amy, welcome. You're up first.
Thank you, Kurt, and thank you, Professor Yu, as well, for joining this panel. I'm really excited for this discussion. I'm just going to get right to it. Let me start with the text of the order itself. So if you haven't read this executive order, in it, the president argues that what the 14th Amendment requires of a person is not just to be born in the United States, but to be born subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And this means subject to a jurisdiction that at the time of birth is both actual and exclusive. So this does not include the U.S.-born children of travelers just passing through or temporarily residing here, who otherwise claim no allegiance to the nation, to our government, because that child at the time is not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. And while the U.S.-born children of permanent resident aliens are citizens regardless of the parents' race, the same is not true for children born of parents within the accepted classes of excludable aliens. Now, I know what many of you are thinking, and I know the presumptions that I believe many of the audience members came in with today. Weren't we all told in law school that the 14th Amendment just adopted common law just solely, and that the Supreme Court, in a case we probably didn't actually read, settled this in Wong Kim Ark by saying that if you're born here, you're a citizen? What complete idiot lawyer did Trump find to write that order, and why isn't he disbarred? I have a plot twist for you. Nothing I read was from Trump's executive order. That was almost verbatim from the explanation of the 14th Amendment given by Henry Campbell Black. Yes, that Henry Campbell Black of Black's Law Dictionary, in his 1910 Handbook of American Constitutional Law, 12 years after Wong Kim Ark allegedly settled this question. And if that's shocking to you, well, hold on to your hats and buckle your seatbelts, because the next few months of argument over this are about to be a bumpy ride. Because you're about to discover something that I discovered several years ago, which is that the narrative typically given to us as the sort of current standard model of the citizenship clause has, at least from an originalist perspective, a very serious history problem. Because in the decades immediately following the amendment's ratification, very serious legal scholars published a whole lot of analyses of its meaning that are very seriously at odds with this modern consensus. If our modern standard model of citizenship is correct, from an originalist standpoint, we should not see such legal stalwarts as Thomas Cooley writing in 1880 con law treatises that birthright citizenship only applies to those born to the full and complete jurisdiction, the type to which citizens generally are subject, and not any qualified or partial jurisdiction, such as may consist with allegiance to some other government. But we do see that. And it's not just him. We see similar analyses around that same time from people like Alexander Porter Morse, from Francis Wharton, from William C. Robinson, who, if you're unfamiliar with him, he was a tenured professor of common law at Yale. All of these people understanding the citizenship clause in ways that are simply incompatible with this notion that Congress just adopted common law just solely wholesale. And if this standard model is correct, and Trump's executive order is truly unprecedented, we should not see executive branch officials in the decades after ratification establishing practices virtually identical to the one established in Trump's executive order, and utilizing almost identical reasoning to that underpinning Trump's order. And yet we have, among other things in the historical record, multiple secretaries of state in the 1880s directing federal officials to deny passports to people who were unquestionably born in the United States, but who were born simultaneously subject to a foreign power and not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Why? Not because their parents were foreign diplomats or members of some invading army under the common law, but because their parents were ordinary foreign citizens who never claimed allegiance to the United States and never intended to reside here permanently. In one case in 1890, because we ultimately decided that the child's mother wasn't an admissible immigrant and was deportable. And if this standard model that we've all been told is correct, and the Supreme Court in Wong Kim Ark definitively held that we just adopted the common law's just solely and virtually all U.S. born children are citizens no matter what, we should not see influential scholars like Henry Campbell Black still writing many years later that birthright citizenship only applies to those born of aliens who are lawfully and permanently residing here. And we certainly should not see as late as 1921 Yale Law Review articles in which proponents of what we would today call universal birthright citizenship are acknowledging both that Wong Kim Ark doesn't apply beyond the narrow confines of people who are permanent resident aliens, but also ceding that this opinion that birthright citizenship should universally apply to them is at odds at that time with the leading scholars of the day. And yet here we are with Richard Florna Jr. publishing just that article. Now, it's my contention that this narrative of the standard model of the citizenship clause runs headlong into a history problem that too few people understand exists and with which even fewer people have bothered to seriously contend. And I think that is going to have to change as this litigation goes forward. And I submit that the reason that the standard model of birthright citizenship has a history problem is because it even more fundamentally has a philosophy problem. The cornerstone of this standard model that we've all been taught, the core argument around which it stands or falls, is this idea that Congress undertook to rectify the atrocity of Dred Scott by simply constitutionalizing the English common law rule of justly, that they constitutionalized this principle that virtually all persons born within the territory of a sovereign owe that sovereign perpetual allegiance, and therefore are subjects of that sovereign, with, of course, some narrow exceptions for the children of foreign diplomats and invading armies. But when you read the entirety of the legislative debates, not just a couple of acontextual half quotes, but you look at it in its entire context, it's not just that you see a Congress that isn't actively trying to adopt the old English common law rule. It's that you see a Congress intentionally telling us they aren't adopting that rule. They're not correcting Dred Scott by reverting to feudal principles of perpetual allegiance that they entirely rejected at the founding. They're correcting Dred Scott, which presented a uniquely American problem with uniquely American concepts of citizenship based not on race, but on complete political allegiance and the strength of association with the American body politic. And perhaps nowhere is this clearer in the debates around than you see in the debates around the language of the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which becomes Congress's first effort to undo Dred Scott. That act's citizenship clause, the first time in American history where we define the parameters of birthright citizenship, we say that it makes citizens of all persons born in the United States and not subject to any foreign power, excluding Indians not taxed. And in recounting how Congress got to this language in the Civil Rights Act, Senator Lyman Trumbull, who's one of the principal authors of that act's citizenship clause, he explains that they were initially just going to write that all persons born in the United States and who owe allegiance to it are citizens. But then he says, we rejected it because upon further investigation, it was found that a sort of allegiance was due to the country from persons temporarily resident in it to whom we have no right to make citizens. And that form would not answer. In other words, someone brought up, hey, they might mistake this under the common law as you trying to make citizens of people who are temporarily resident here. And they said, oh, we're not doing that. And this makes sense, too, in sort of the broader context of these debates, where you're seeing a lot of these same congressmen just several years earlier during the Civil War have these same conversations about citizenship and allegiance, except for purposes of the draft. Who is sufficiently subject to our jurisdiction? Who is sufficiently no longer subject to a foreign power such that we can compel them to bear arms for our nation? And the line that they draw is one of people who are citizens and those born in a foreign nation who reside here and who have filed their declaration of intent to naturalize, basically the equivalent of what we would today call lawful permanent residents who have taken that first step towards citizenship. This is the same concept of what it means to be no longer subject to a foreign power that they take with them to the Civil Rights Act. And this understanding of allegiance, it's not the common law view. It's a Republican, small r, view of complete political allegiance that's uncomplicated by allegiance simultaneously owed to another government. And I know that the counter argument that I anticipate John will bring up and that is basically the standard sort of model for the view of just solely is that, well, even if that's what Congress did in the Civil Rights Act, they abrogated it with broader language in the 14th Amendment. Put aside that, I think that takes some fantastical mental gymnastics to believe that the same Congress that just passed a Republican ideal of citizenship then immediately turned around and said, nah, we're just kidding. It's just solely it is. They told us what they were doing. They weren't abrogating the Civil Rights Act. They were constitutionalizing it. And again, you see this very explicitly. It's just one example. You know, Senator Reverdy Johnson, during the debates over the language of the 14th Amendment, arguing all that this amendment provides is that all persons born in the United States and not subject to some foreign power, for that no doubt is the meaning of the committee who have brought the matter before us, shall be considered as citizens of the United States. To them, it meant the same thing. That's also why Congress reenacts the Civil Rights Act verbatim in 1870. It's also why that statutory definition remains valid federal law for the next 70 years. They're not in conflict. And so I think, again, there is this narrative that doesn't make sense, this standard narrative that doesn't make sense of all of these historical and legislative historical realities. But I think there is a narrative that does make sense of that text history and tradition in a way that the current standard model does not and cannot make sense of it. And that, I think, is precisely the argument espoused by the executive order and by legal stalwarts like Henry Campbell Black, and that you've seen sort of throughout this history, this idea that we did not constitutionalize just solely in its entirety, but that what the 14th Amendment does is create a sense of citizenship where, yes, we have removed any permanent race-based barriers to citizenship, but there are still barriers based on the strength of a person's allegiance to the United States, their lack of political allegiance to a foreign power, and also just their general sense of being tied into the American body politic. And when you see the history in light of that lens, I think it makes a whole lot more sense. And so in that sense, then, you don't have a presidential order that is ahistorical, that is out of the blue. And it is perfectly consistent with that original understanding meaning and also with, again, some of those earliest practices that we see in the historical record. I think my time is just about up. I want to be respectful of that. So it's a bit of an abrupt ending. But at that point, I will turn it over to Professor Yu.
All right. Thank you, Amy. John.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing this important debate. And it's great to see Kurt. Kurt and I spent, what would it be, 30 hours, one semester, sitting in listening to Akhil Amar's theory of the Reconstruction Amendments, which somehow I'm sad to see Kurt totally bought hook, line, and sinker and turned into a whole career. Jesus.
Well, I'm now fighting with Akhil.
But I have to say, Kurt had the career that I wish I had followed because I ended up not writing about those topics. We're fortunate to have, I think, the leading scholar about the history of the 14th Amendment with us, and I'm curious to see what he's going to say. And I'm glad to see Amy. I think John Malcolm's just afraid to come out and debate on this one, so he sent out his loyal soldier, Amy, out here to do battle on behalf of the Heritage Foundation and its support of the executive order. I'm sorry, I'm not going to engage, I hope, in fantastical legal reasoning that Amy suggested those of us who believe in birthright citizenship must hold. I think this is not just the traditional reading of the Birthright Citizenship Clause, but I think it's the correct one when you look at all the history, you look at the text and the structure of the amendment, and you look at its ratification history. And it's a serious practical import. I'd ask Amy, I just want to, I hope she'll answer this question when we return. But if you accept her argument, then you have to have believed that Kamala Harris was an unconstitutional vice president because her parents were, I believe, doctoral students of some kind and researchers when they were here temporarily when she was born, and that it was unconstitutional for her to run for president. So I'm curious whether she believes this. I think that's the implication of the argument. Let's see whether you believe in the actual practical import, because it's not just, if you're right, that the president can issue an executive order saying that birthright citizenship is not to be acknowledged going forward. But I assume it means you think everyone who had birthright citizenship, because though had non-citizen parents, are illegal citizens. And then does that mean their children are all illegal aliens? I'm really not sure what the rule that's supposed to replace this is, because Amy made mention of a theory which has really been developed by the Claremont Institute folks, John Eastman and his friends. I think it really starts with a fellow named Ed Erler, who's a professor of political science at CSU San Bernardino. There's this idea that there's some kind of Republican theory of citizenship. How is this Republican theory of citizenship different than the jus sanguinis rule, the idea that your citizenship is determined by the citizenship of your parents? Because that is, seems to me, the rule that you're arguing for and that my Claremont friends are arguing for, which is the rule of the Roman law and the rule of old Europe. And it surprises me to hear my friends who defend the American Revolution and the Declaration of Independence think that our founders rejected the English common law rule, despite no evidence that they did so in the antebellum period, and instead wanted to embrace the rule of true empire, the rule that came from the Roman Empire and survives in Europe to this day, right? As you all know, I'm sure on the podcast, almost all the countries of the Roman law have jus sanguinis, not jus soli. So first, let me also say, I find this a curious argument, although I'm a curious issue that all the focus is coming to in terms of immigration. I think President Trump's immigration policies are much more radical in the idea of declaring an invasion on the southern border and using and deploying the military to handle the flows of illegal aliens across the southern border, which, as we all know, resulted in something like 3 million people a year coming across the border under the Biden administration. When birthright citizenship, the numbers are hard to get to, but it looks like there's about 150,000 babies born in the United States to parents who are not here legally. This is by a whole order of magnitude not that important. But I see, of course, that it has enormous symbolic reasons. And also, let me just say before I start that President Trump, of course, has the right as the president to adopt a different view of the Constitution than the one the courts hold. And he certainly has the right to advance that interpretation of the Constitution and try to see if the courts will change their minds. Right? He's certainly entitled to order the State Department not to issue passports to babies who don't have citizen parents or permanent resident alien parents, and see if he can get the court to overturn Wong Kim Ark. I think he's going to lose. Now, I'm sorry that he's going to waste enormous amounts of legal and political capital and resources to do it, but I think that's what's going to come. But he's certainly within his rights as president to do it. So in terms of the text, Kurt started us off and Amy discussed quite rightly, the key phrase is this subject to the jurisdiction thereof in the 14th Amendment. Right. And I think the court got right in Wong Kim Ark. I think this view was expressed by senators when the 14th Amendment was actually introduced in the Congress, that this refers to three classes of people, right? The children of diplomats, the children of soldiers occupying territory of the United States, which seems fanciful now, but remember, this is being done right after the Civil War, when half the country was occupied, but we considered enemy troops. and Indians, which is uniquely an American issue, and Indians becoming citizens didn't occur for many decades after. I agree that it's important we look at the history. I think a lot of the authorities Amy cited are not really on point in that they come so late after the founding. Well, they do come very late after the founding, but the founding of the Reconstruction Amendments. I'm glad Black's Law Dictionary includes this definition. I'm not very persuaded by the date 1910. I would just point out, it's obviously, when it comes to the 14th Amendment, unfortunately, quite possible for later interpreters to get it seriously wrong. And all we have to do is point to Plessy versus Ferguson, which was even earlier than Henry Campbell Black, and I think got the 14th Amendment completely wrong. I don't think it's a good idea to cite authorities who come decades after the amendment was written, just as a matter of practically doing originalism, because it's very possible for politics and legal agendas to cause people to interpret things incorrectly. I'm afraid that's what happened in Plessy versus Ferguson. It may well be the case with people who are writing 40 to 50 years after the ratification of the amendment. The other thing is, what did the 14th Amendment do? Why did the founders, the Reconstruction Congress, create it? If you agree with Amy and the government, you have to assume, I believe, that during the antebellum period, we did not have jus soli citizenship. Because why the four, otherwise then the 14th Amendment, I think it is, can't be this, but they would have to say, otherwise they're reading the 14th Amendment is a complete change in the rule that the United States had had between the founding and the Reconstruction Amendments, right? I think both sides in this debate argue that the 14th Amendment really tried to, obviously one, reverse the rule of Dred Scott, but then two, more codified the understanding of citizenship, and that Dred Scott, this had to be done because Dred Scott itself had violated the traditional rule of citizenship. And as you know, the jus soli idea comes from the English common law. And during the antebellum period, as you all know, the Constitution does not contain a definition of citizenship itself. It looks like states basically ran immigration policy. If you think about what Dred Scott did, accepted basically Southern states' definition of citizenship as not including African Americans. There is no sign, as far as I can tell. I've done a lot of research into this. I've talked to a lot of people who share Amy's view. What is the evidence that during the antebellum period, any American state used a jus sanguinis rule, that any state rejected jus soli? I'm sorry, I can't see it. In fact, there are Supreme Court cases during this period which observe that the American rule is jus soli, that there is no antebellum record. I've looked at the historians of immigration law and immigration policy, books upon books. They all say that birthright citizenship is the rule of the antebellum period. If there is real historical, solid historical evidence that there are states which adopted the jus sanguinis rule, then let's see it. The only thing I have seen people write in the Claremont Institute rule world is that there are some states which extend jus sanguinis to citizens who are born outside the United States. Right? But that almost proves that in the U.S. it's jus soli. And these are just one or two states, as far as I know. That inference just does not override, I think, massive practice and judicial decisions, at the Supreme Court that observe that jus soli is the rule during the antebellum period. If that's the case, then the 14th Amendment makes sense. It's not some radical overturning of the way the common law, as incorporated by the states at the time of the founding and the time of the Revolution, handled citizenship. It also seems strange to me that the 14th Amendment's drafters, that the radical Republicans in Congress, and again, Kurt is a real expert on this, but it seems strange to me that they would overturn Dred Scott. I think one of the great blemishes on our constitutional history, to say that African Americans and their children born in the United States are citizens, and then to narrow citizenship at the same time to everybody else, because that is what the government, that is what Amy is arguing here, isn't it? If the states had all used jus soli beforehand. It also seems to me that, and we could go through the legislative history. I'm not so sure what the legislative history shows, because just looking at an article by Jim Ho, who sources tell me is now a judge these days, but Jim goes through the legislative history in great detail, and he said, he concludes, and he produces, I guess, what Amy characterized as half quotes. He produces multiple discussions in the debates that say, right, exactly what Juan Kimark was going to say, exactly what I said, that this under the jurisdiction thereof refers to these three classes of unusual people in the United States: diplomats, occupying armies, and Indians. Maybe Jim is wrong. I'm the only person I know of who's actually read every page of the Reconstruction Congress debates for all three amendments is, in fact, Kurt Lash. So, Kurt, you tell us. But I don't see massive legislative history running the other way. I don't see evidence that this is the way the amendment is explained to the state ratification conventions. I don't see any history of debates in the state ratification conventions that say, oh, yes, this is getting rid of this terrible rule of birthright citizenship, which we have had in the antebellum period. In fact, for the most part, we don't see a lot of debate at all. And so I don't think legislative history overcomes the natural reading of the text. So just one, let me just end by just addressing this point if I'm at the end of time, I'm happy to stop. And then Kurt, you know, take over. Thanks well, how about with this? Me. I didn't realize I was used up all my time, but I'm done.
To be flexible about it, keep in mind the point you're about to make. But I do want to make sure that we have time for you two to engage one another. And maybe during that engagement, John, you can continue to make the point you were about to.
I have already forgotten the point.
There you go. Okay, it's already gone. Amy, I wanted to give you a chance maybe to respond, maybe ask some questions of John. He's asked you the Vice President Harris question. Akhil Amar these days asks the Akhil Amar question, am I unconstitutional, because he was born to parents who were not citizens, were legally present, but were not citizens at the time of his birth. So you can respond to that, or you can respond to anything that really caught your attention, or maybe expand upon your own ideas. Go ahead.
Sure. And for the sake of time, I might have to cut that. I have a running list of questions here, and I don't think I'm going to have time to get to all of them. So I'll try to.
Oh, also, Amy, I'm sorry. Your microphone is kind of cutting in and out. There probably isn't anything you can do about that, but slow and clear would be helpful.
Okay. Is this better?
Yes.
All right. I've got a running list of questions. Questions that John asked, and I will try to address all of them. But I know we've got some time constraints. I'll start with your first question, which is it unconstitutional for Kamala Harris to have run for or been president? And I'll tie that in with what I think was a separate but related question. Does this mean everyone prior to this order who we've treated as a citizen who wouldn't be covered by this order is retrospectively to be considered some illegal usurper of citizenship, I guess? And the answer is yes to the first question. Or, yes, insofar as was it constitutional for Kamala Harris to run for president? To my knowledge, yes. I'm not overly familiar with the circumstances of her birth, but to the extent that we have treated her or any other person as a full American citizen under what I would say is not constitution, under the mandate of the 14th Amendment itself, but as a matter of policy, Or as a matter of, I think this would apply again to natural born citizens who are born outside of the United States as well, right? To citizen parents, right, who are brought back in, raised in the United States, that citizenship isn't in question. And I think this is actually one of the strongest aspects of this order is I think you'd run into a number of problems if you try to retroactively go back and start stripping citizenship from people who we as a nation have said their entire lives, you are a citizen, here's your passport, we're treating you as a citizen, you are exercising the rights, duties, and privileges of citizenship. Just kidding, and we strip that from you. I think you run into a number of problems there. But I, to be clear, I don't think that was required under the wording of the 14th Amendment. But I think as a matter of principle and policy, to the extent we have treated those individuals as citizens, congratulations. Like I don't think that is problematic, right? And I don't think that takes away from the president's ability to prospectively going forward stop that policy that is broader than the actual mandate of the 14th Amendment. I do want to clarify, John, you've sort of multiple times framed my argument as, well, we as a nation never adopted any semblance of jus soli, that it was always jus sanguinis, and that my argument is, well, we constitutionalized jus sanguinis. And that's not quite right. On the one hand, we did not constitutionalize, or I think really ever broadly in this country, adopt the full extent of the English common law of jus soli. We Americanized it. From the very beginning, there's a tension between principles inherent in true common law jus soli and the American principles of the revolution. And so jus soli is a feudalistic principle that with it comes something like perpetual allegiance, which you can read all through both at the time of the founding itself, but then also in and around the amendment, this complete repudiation of perpetual allegiance, that you are born owing allegiance to this sovereign, that you have no right of expatriation. You can never pledge your allegiance to another country. You have no right of expatriation. That's always been intention in this country. And this would not be the first time that we have Americanized or adopted sort of a Republican, again, small R form of the common law. You see this with Tucker's Blackstone and the way that he talks about our adoption of the common law Second Amendment, of the English Bill of Rights and the right to keep and bear arms, how we had an Americanized version of that. And just to give you one example of where you see this in the antebellum period, you see this even with Joseph's story. So when you pull up Joseph's story, I want to get the quote right here so as not to be accused of making this up. You have Joseph's story in his...
Everyone's Googling Joseph's story.
I know. This is what happens when you write something with 400 footnotes in it. But you... Oh, my goodness. Of course, this happens the moment that I pick it up.
Amy, okay,
I will find the footnote. I will find the footnote in it. But you have this quote by Joseph Story where he is talking about the common law rule, and he says that a reasonable construction of this, like sort of a reasonable asterisk on this, would of course be to exclude not only the children of those who are diplomats, but also those who are in itinerary in this country, who are here residing temporarily, either for business purposes or for just temporary things like health. So you start to see this Americanization of this, even with principles of stalwarts of common law like Joseph Story. And you see this Americanization, this concept of it, again, in these debates over this language of the 14th Amendment, where they're not repudiating this entirety of jus soli or completely adopting jus sanguinis. They're their conception of it by this time is Americanized. So I want to be clear about that. I'm not suggesting that there is no conception of jus soli in there. Of course there is. But it is much more limited and based on ties of allegiance and sort of your the positional relationship of your parents to that country.
Amy, again, just in terms, because we're running out of time. John, I think that Amy makes an interesting point. Regarding not a denial of jus soli or denial of the role of common law, but arguing perhaps between the time of the founding and the Civil War, it's a more complicated cake that we have, and maybe a more Americanized version of it that shades more closely to her argument. What do you think about that? Boop, you're muted.
I just don't see the historical evidence for it, Kurt. I mean, I take the argument. I've read the theories for this. They are primarily people who are political theorists who are saying the American Revolution adopts this kind of Lockean social compact where we have citizenship by consent, and this is the American rule. But when you ask, well, how does that rule actually work? Do you see any evidence of any state adopting that rule? Right. What is this rule that you're talking about? It's a jus soli rule plus an exception? Is it the same exception you're talking about, that we actually don't have birthright citizenship within any state in the United States before the Civil War? I just don't see any historical evidence of that. I've asked people, show me the actual statutes in any state that adopts a rule that is fundamentally different than birthright citizenship. Of course, the states are allowed to adopt the common law and then modify it as they do it. And that's what happened, right? The common law does not operate of its own magic force upon the revolution, but all the states, I think every state, passed statutes adopting the common law in toto, and then they can adopt it and change it by statute. I don't see any statutes that do that for citizenship. So if there are such statutes, please cite them. I want to see them. I mean, it would change my mind if there were actually. But this actually goes, I think, to the way Amy answered the Kamala Harris question. Because when she says, well, of course, Kamala Harris is a citizen. And she says, of course, all the children who are born to illegal aliens in the history of the country since the 14th Amendment are citizens, because she said we've treated them that way. Well, what is the legal source for the power to do that? It's not coming from the 14th Amendment under your reading, right? Because under your reading, you don't get citizenship by being born in the country, and they are illegal aliens or temporary sojourners, as you called them, people, students on visas. Then where does the legal authority come from to treat them as citizens under your view? It doesn't come from the Constitution. As far as I know, no congressional statute actually extends citizenship. In my view, it's not necessary, because already we all know that's birthright citizenship is the rule. So it would be duplicative for Congress just to pass another statute saying we are guaranteeing birthright citizenship. But you have a problem, because your problem is, then where does the legal authority come from to grant citizenship to all of these children of illegal aliens and their descendants? Just saying the government just chose to give it to them. Why would that be constitutional? I just don't see. And this is the hard thing. And this is my direct answer to Kurt, is how does this rule, that is, if you believe jus soli is not the rule, how does the rule work? You've just said it's not jus sanguinis either. So what is it? So the people in the Claremont Institute, they say they have this view that you almost don't really have citizenship until you reach the age of majority, until you're 18 and you're a full independent person, and then you can consent. And both the community and the individual consent to being part of the American community. Maybe that is the right working out of Locke. Maybe it's not. I'm not sure. But I don't think there has been any state that has ever adopted that kind of procedure. And I don't think the country ever has either. That's why I think what they're doing, I'm not saying Amy's doing it, but I think the intellectual fathers and mothers of this idea, they are trying to take their reading of Locke and sort of impose it on their interpretation of the 14th Amendment. Whereas the things that we as lawyers traditionally look at, text, structure, history, don't support it at all.
something.
Oh, by the way, the story, I did find the story quote. Yeah, it's actually, there's a case where he was a justice. It's called Inglis. But actually, the quote says, nothing is better settled at the common law than use solely.
It's his commentaries on the conflict of laws in 1830. And I'm happy to quote it to you. It's
you have to quote it, Amy, because we're all waiting. Do it.
So, quote, and this is after he has again articulated the common law, this understanding of the common law within the United States. He says, quote, a reasonable qualification, again, talking of the rule of citizenship by virtue of birth on U.S. soil, would seem to be that it should not apply to children of parents who were in itinere in the country or abiding there for temporary purposes as for health or occasional business. Joseph Story, Commentaries on the Conflict of Laws, 48, 1834.
Perfect.
Also,
I would say Story's view as a justice would be more compelling. And so there's this case called Inglis, 28 U.S.C. at 164, where he says nothing is better settled at the common law than use solely. So.
If I may, now that we're getting into very cogent use of sources and arguing over sources, something occurred to me while listening to the two of you giving your presentations that I think members of the audience are probably wondering about as well. And I want to get to some of the questions of the audience. Amy, you've been characterized as relying a lot, and I think this is fair. You've been characterized as relying a lot on sources that post-date the ratification of the 14th Amendment, and you rely on legal commentators who, of course, are experts, and so they're perfectly valid sources for you to rely on. But a lot of these kind of were coming after. Not all of them. You have Joseph Story before, but you have a lot of commentators afterwards. John, it sounded to me like you were relying a great deal on certain ideas that had developed in common law prior to the adoption of the 14th Amendment. And John, I think that you conceded that it's kind of difficult to derive a rule out of the actual debates. You know, you haven't investigated those yourselves, but you've read some other people who've grappled with that idea. What if we're in a situation where we have a choice between two kinds of sources? Maybe we don't have the originalist golden key out of the debates, but we have to determine whether or not to look at the tradition that developed prior to the 14th Amendment or the tradition that had to do with commentary on the 14th Amendment. Between the two of you, Amy, and this is a question to you as well, how do we decide which tradition should inform our understanding of the clause, those coming before or those coming afterwards?
Well, I think at the very least, you have to understand, and again, this goes to John's point about statutes that may exist within states as to how states understood citizenship within the state. Part of this comes back to this idea of having to understand what did the people who drafted and ratified the 14th Amendment mean by this? Because if they are explicitly telling us, as I believe they do throughout the debates, both on the Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment, that we're not actually adopting the full extent of common law jus soli, but that we at the very least have sort of an Americanized version of it that is based off of principles of allegiance, where we are removing these race-based barriers to citizenship for people who, like the descendants, the U.S.-born descendants of slaves, clearly do not owe allegiance to any foreign power. We really have to take them at their word. That would seem to hold some weight that they are explicitly telling us, hey, these are things that we considered, and we chose this language specifically so as to avoid debates in the future that we were adopting common law jus soli and saying, hey, anybody who owes temporary allegiance, you are now citizens, your kids are now citizens. So I think that has to be taken into account. And I think when you look at these early scholars, that's what they're doing. They are understanding, and these are, yes, so when I quote Henry Campbell Black, that was 1910, but that was in reference to what people were thinking after Wong Kim Ark. All throughout my law review article, I'm looking at 1875, 1880. You have the slaughterhouse cases, the first time that the Supreme Court starts to touch on this. Our articulating that same view that this would exclude not just the children of foreign ambassadors and invading armies, but also those who are foreign citizens, namely those who are not intending to become citizens here. So I think you see this not just in the debates, but you see this carry on in contemporary scholarship and in contemporary court cases. And I think we don't have time to get into Benny, but I think to from the Jersey Supreme Court, which is something that the court in Juan Kimar relies upon, they're espousing the same principles that I am articulating, but they're just wrapping it in this idea of, well, it's use solely, but when you look at it, it's really an Americanized version of use solely. And so I think that ought to weigh heavily against whatever conception we may have had or struggled with or been in tension with in the century leading up to that. If they're okay. telling us All right. something specific, we ought to listen.
I'm sorry, the ratification history does not say what you say it does. You make it sound as if there's this unanimous, multi-person, people in authority interpreting the amendments text this way publicly to the state ratification debates. It's not even the case with Congress. So again, look at Jim Ho's article. He quotes the person who introduces this language into the 14th Amendment, Senator Howard, who says the meaning of that language are these three categories of people. That's why I say the legislative history just is not clear. I'm not saying every single statement bears to support my interpretation. I think there's probably quotes on both sides of it. But what's important for an originalist is not what is said afterwards. What's important for originalists is what did the people who ratified the amendment say? I would not use the slaughterhouse cases as an example on your side, Amy, because that is a great example. And I know Kurt believes, as he wrote a whole book about it, is a great example how the Supreme Court got the privileges and immunities clause utterly wrong, despite hundreds of quotes during the ratification process and in Congress about how you really incorporated the Bill of Rights. It's a great example, actually, of how wrong subsequent interpreters so quickly could get and reject what the Reconstruction Congress was trying to do. And so I think as an originalist, what you do, I don't think this is unusual or strange. You try to understand the words and the way those with the legal authority to adopt the amendment would have thought those words meant. That's why I would look at states. That's why I would look at what is the antebellum rule? What is the practice? Because the people who voted in the state ratification conventions, the people who, and there, of course, as Kurt has pointed out and others have discussed, there are funny problems with the way the amendments were ratified. But we don't really have great records. We don't, as far as I know, have records of any state ratification debate that rejects birthright citizenship. Maybe Congress would show, if you had people in Congress saying, yeah, we know the legal words would normally be interpreted this way, but we're rejecting it. We give it our own meaning. Maybe you would have a case. I think that's actually true of the Privileges and Immunities Clause. That's a great example of how the people in the Reconstruction Congress took a phrase that had been used with and gave it an obscure, right, out of the mainstream reading, but then incorporated it into the 14th Amendment to incorporate the Bill of Rights. That's not what would happen with citizenship. You just don't see any evidence of that. Again, I would want to see the practice in the states or from the state ratification debates saying, yes, the common law, yes, all these people, we've given citizenship this meaning, but we are rejecting it with the 14th Amendment's text, even though we're using words which would suggest otherwise.
Word, again, is coming up against the clock. A couple of questions, well, a lot of questions in the queue have to do with the actual debates, and I'm afraid that's a little beyond what we're able to engage here. But I've one of the first questions out of the gate had to do with your predictions about how the Supreme Court is likely to engage the question. And then numerous questions had to do with the relevance of Native American tribes and the situation of Native Americans and what role that should play in our understanding of what's going on. John, I think that would be particularly important to you because the treatment of Native American tribes doesn't exactly track to common law. It's a fairly unique American situation. So, Toot, I'd just like to throw those out to you. You each have about three and a half minutes. Either talk about the importance of the Native American experience or your prediction of the Supreme Court or both, whatever you can get in. So, Amy, perhaps you'd like to start?
Sure. So I'll start with the prediction and then and go to the conversation about the Native American tribes. I'll be honest. I think Donald Trump's order should be upheld. I think it is consistent with the original meaning of the 14th Amendment. I also, my other full-time day job is doing Second Amendment work, where we have an ostensibly originalist court that is declining to even take up things like an assault weapons case, in major Second Amendment cases. So I'm a little bit hesitant to think that, you know, the court is that same court is necessarily in this very controversial case going to necessarily come down on the side that I think is correct. I might actually anticipate something to the contrary. I think if I were a betting person, and again, I don't want to make percentage bets or put money on it because you never want to do that with the Supreme Court. I would actually anticipate that there is a good chance that this ends up very close, but the executive order being struck down, which I think would be unfortunate, and I hope I'm wrong. As for the Native American debates, again, I think this is very important. And I think one of the reasons it's important is because that is when you read through the ratification debates for all of this. And John, I will say, to my knowledge, I have read. So now you know two people who have read all of the debates surrounding this.
I meant all the Reconstruction debates, 13th, 14th, and 15th, because that's what Kurt did.
I'll tip my hat to that. when you look at, because this is the question that comes up is, well, why do you see this change in the language between the Civil Rights Act and the 14th Amendment? And when you do read that, the debate surrounding this, that comes largely, again, from this trying to incorporate that same requirement, that same sort of distinction between people who are just sort of temporarily owing a qualified allegiance. How do we apply that to the Native American tribes, to people who are still tribally affiliated? Because those aren't foreign powers, but they are sort of subject to our jurisdiction. You had some concerns from some senators using just the term Indians not taxed. Okay, well, what if you had Native Americans who left their tribal affiliations, who were completely subject to United States jurisdiction, who are exercising the rights, duties, and privileges of citizenship, but they're too poor to owe taxes? Like, do they count? And what do you do with the people who aren't tribally affiliated but still don't recognize our authority? So they're wrestling with that in a very real way. And so that's why you see that change in language. But importantly, what they're not wrestling with in any of that is this concept of, oh, well, did we really intend to not make citizens of people who, you know, are subject to foreign powers, who owe us a lesser level of allegiance because they're here temporarily? Did we really mean that? No, they're trying to apply that in the same manner to find that correct language, that adequate language for that distinction with the Native American tribes.
Thank you. I have to leave room for John because we're coming up at the end. Thank you, Amy. I apologize.
I have to confess, I actually have read the debates about this provision, but it's a very, very small part of the debates about the Reconstruction Amendments. There aren't that many pages if people want to, you know, read them themselves. Indian tribes are interesting because, again, I think here's a case where you have someone who, in the Senate, talking about this amendment, who explained that Indians are not covered by this language because Indian tribes are quasi-foreign nations. That's the phrase that the senator used. They're quasi foreign nations, has always been treated in law. Of course, this is from the Chief Justice Marshall's famous opinions. And so they're not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. It's a great example of why this phrase, subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, does not mean you have to have parents who are citizens. It's because they were thought to be sovereign nations themselves inside the country. and it's seen again as a narrow exception. And as I think as you're suggesting, Kurt, the way our country handles that is that Congress eventually passes a law that extends citizenship. I think it's like in 1924. What the Supreme Court's going to, but actually it's a good, I think it's a, the treatment of Indians is a good point in my favor because it actually shows how this understanding of this phrase subject to the jurisdiction thereof works out and how it can be extended by Congress. I don't think that's present here for everybody else. In terms of what the Supreme Court's going to do, I think, you know, if you look at the Supreme Court's approach to using text, structure, original understanding, and then what they call history and tradition, I got to think the Supreme Court's going to strike down the executive order. Like I said in the beginning, you know, the President Trump's immigration EOs are quite radical. I think most of them will actually probably survive. But I think this has become the symbolic flashpoint that we'll get to the Supreme Court. I think President Trump's going to lose, and it's going to consume a lot of time and energy that could be better spent on something else in immigration. But I can't see. Can anyone listening to this podcast actually see Chief Justice John Roberts saying, rejecting birthright citizenship? It's very, very hard for me to see that.
Well, thank you. Thank you both. We're at the end of our allotted time. I want to thank the Federal Society, and I especially want to thank Amy and John for engaging in such a civil discussion, an intense discussion, but a civil discussion. I think it's exemplary, and it's a good model for all of us because it's an important subject. It's a passionate subject, but it's one that needs critical analysis like we've seen today. So thank you all, and thank you all for joining us here at the Federal Society.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.